Okay, so this is the first in the Take Good Care series on sleep. And we'll start out by introducing ourselves. I'm Lisa Kircher. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and a parent at the school. I have three children who have attended the school, one who is currently a junior in high school, and one in eighth grade, and one in sixth grade. So we've been at the school for 14 years.
Wow.
Yeah, long time.
That's a long time.
I know. It is. Go ahead.
I am Michelle Dawson, and I'm a licensed clinical psychologist, and I have two kids at the school. Jack is in first grade, and Abby is in fifth grade, and both of them started in the toddler program. So we've been here for 7 years.
Is that 7 years? Interestingly, my middle child is the first graduating class of toddlers.
Oh, wow.
So he's part of the first toddler class, and they graduate this year.
Oh, that's amazing.
So come to graduation. So just briefly, we'll talk to you a little bit about what we hope to cover during this talk, which is new research and findings on why sleep is critical, what gets in our way and why. Is that a fair way to say it?
Yeah.
How to access a better night's sleep every night, and shortcuts for the nights that just don't seem to go so well. So why sleep? I'm going to talk a little bit about the brain research about why it's important to sleep and what people have started to learn about sleep. So in general, sleep in America, these are just some basic facts. I thought this was interesting that man and woman, they are the only mammals that willingly delay sleep.
That's true.
Yeah.
Just watch your dog.
They actually talked about that dogs do a really good job of preparing for sleep, that they go in a circle,
right.
They get themselves comfortable, they kind of settle into themselves and go to sleep.
Right.
And we don't do it that way. More than a third of Americans are sleep deprived, and they discuss sleep deprivation as less than 7 hours of sleep.
So by the way, Lisa and I are both sleep deprived right now, officially.
It is true.
Yes.
It is true. So 40 million people a year suffer from chronic sleep disorders. And, you know, those are obviously sleep disorders that occur on a regular basis. Most people take sleep medication for that. But 20 million people a year experience occasional sleep issues. This is really important because these are things like when we're struggling to sleep because we're a parent. Right? Our kids are getting us up in the middle of the night. We have a high level of stress because of our job. Maybe we worked a little bit too late. That all falls into that 20 million people. I think it's important to know that sleep issues account for an estimated $16 billion in medical costs a year. That is really actually a very low estimate because right now they're just starting to figure out the chicken and the egg, what came first. Are some of the medical conditions because we're not getting enough sleep? Or is it traditional theory that we struggle to sleep because of the medical conditions? So they're just starting to break that down a little bit more. So I think that number is going to go up pretty significantly in the next few years.
And I just saw a study on, it gave a number on how much it affects like the loss for companies financially because sleep deprivation causes people to obviously get these diseases, but also miss work. And so it's like drastically impacts our economy as well.
Yeah. So the number is low, and that's a huge number.
Yeah.
Snoring is the number one cause of sleep disturbance for approximately 90 million American adults. I don't think that that's surprising. If you slept in my house, you would know that it's not. Sorry, honey. And most importantly, sleep has been found to be the strongest predictor of mental resilience. Mm. That is really important to note. Okay, so the beautiful, mysterious brain and questions unanswered. From an evolutionary perspective, it was really dangerous to sleep, right? I mean, if we fell asleep, we were in danger of being attacked. Yet, we never evolved not to need sleep. And so scientists always were really interested in what is the importance of sleep? Why are we doing it? So we've researched why and how much sleep we need. But we really didn't have a clear-cut answer. We were just guessing. So we looked at people over time. You know, if you're rested, how much better do you function? how much sleep do you actually need to perform well? And so they guesstimated correctly that we need about 8 hours of sleep. That's a little bit high, but we need about 8 hours of sleep. So, but that was really just a guesstimate. But they thought that the brain was really just a tremendous recycler of waste. They thought that it didn't have its own cleaning mechanism. And the only other part of our body that doesn't have a self-cleaning system is our mouth. And our mouth uses saliva, but they didn't understand how our brain was doing it. And that's really expensive real estate, right? To not have a cleaning mechanism. And so they felt like it's really expensive in terms of energy and space. So cleansing the brain was really a mystery, and they just didn't know how it was happening. So enter these Danish scientists in about 2013. It's actually a really funny story. The way it was told to me is that these scientists are studying these mice. Well, mice are really expensive in research, right? I mean, and so they're watching these mice, and the head researcher tells these young college students that they need to sit and watch the mice all night, and they cannot let anything happen to these mice because they're very expensive mice. But they're teenagers, I mean, older teenagers in college, and they invite their couple friends in, they have a couple beers, nothing too rowdy. They aren't watching the mice, and they discover all of a sudden that the mice, their cerebral spinal fluid is drastically reduced, and they freak out. What is happening? Why? We've killed these mice, we've ruined this research study, this is a huge deal. So they call the head researcher, he comes in. By the time he gets in, their cerebral spinal fluid is normal. And he's thinking, what is happening? So he says to them, that's it. You need to sit here. You need to watch these mice for multiple nights. You need to measure their cerebral spinal fluid. And from that came a pretty enormous discovery that has really turned conventional thinking on its head about sleep. So this is what they found. That cerebral spinal fluid is actually quite magical. It is what protects our brain during the day. But what they're finding is that while we're sleeping, the blood in our brain retreats, and it compresses our brain, which grows smaller. And so then there's large empty spaces in our brain. And that allows the cerebral spinal fluid to actually move in and around our brain. And it's actually cleaning out the toxins that build up during the day in our brain. So one of the really interesting pieces of this is that there's ongoing research right now that they believe that it's possibly removing these A-beta plaques, which are a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. And when they've really been looking at this, they've said that those who are reporting sleeping poorly actually had more A-beta plaque on brain imaging. Those who were sleeping better had less. So they're trying to figure out, conventional thinking has been, right, that when you have Alzheimer's, then we don't sleep well. But what they're starting to think is, hold on a second, maybe because we're not sleeping well, it's putting us at increased risk for Alzheimer's. And maybe we need to think about this differently. They're also starting to look at depression this way, right? We've long thought that depression, when we have depression, we're not sleeping well. But it might, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Back to that whole argument. And so obviously this is important, the Alzheimer's piece of this, because Alzheimer's is expected to strike almost 14 million Americans by 2050.
Did you tell me 1 out of 2 people gets it?
No.
Okay.
Not me. But
somebody recently told me that. It's very scary.
I don't doubt that.
Yeah.
It's actually really interesting because there's 5.7 million people today in America. And you think about that jump to 14 million by 2050. That's...
Yeah. So we have to wonder what's contributing to it. And I know there's a lot of research out there.
Mm-hmm.
So
It's really fascinating. So how long does the cleaning take? This is really important because we have to start asking ourselves, okay, what can I do to limit my risk? And so we cycle through, what they discovered was, we cycle through 5 stages of sleep roughly every 90 minutes. So that's about 7.5 hours of sleep. What they're saying is, to get the full effects of the body's natural detox, they think if you get at least 7, you're getting the full effect of the detox. So it's interesting to think back that they used to think, okay, 8 hours is optimal. Well, what they're adding into that too is like 30 minutes to fall asleep, settle down, 30 minutes kind of to wake up, or 20 minutes to wake up. So when you really look at that 7.5 hours with the fall asleep, wake up on both ends, you're at about 8 hours. So we knew what we needed. We just didn't understand what in the world our brain was doing during that time. So a lot of people ask questions like, does it matter if it's consistent sleep or broken sleep? Do we have to get 7 hours of sleep in a row? Or is it okay if it's we nap? They don't know. And so they say it's better to sleep than not sleep. So go ahead and take that nap. The problem with napping for a lot of us is that then we don't sleep at night. And so it's better probably to get the consistent sleep. So it's always good to try to get those 7 hours. If you can't, napping is fine as long as it doesn't mess you up at night. The other question oftentimes is sleeping medications. What the brain researchers are saying is that you would rather get sleep with sleeping medication than not sleep. Obviously, you probably need to add in a few more hours, or at least another hour on top of that 7. So maybe getting 8 would be more beneficial, because obviously it does impact your sleep a little bit, the depth of it. And then there's this idea about age, right? That as we age, our brain doesn't rebound as quickly. So we know now, we don't know exactly, maybe you know something different, but our brains are not fully developed until we're almost 27 years old, and they keep upping it, right? They used to say it was 24, mm-hmm. then 25, then 26, then 27. And now they're saying at about 27, they think our brain is fully developed.
Right.
That's fascinating. So if you think about it, your brain is a little bit more pliable when you're young. So if you pull that all-nighter, you know, if you're out with your friends, your brain can rebound more quickly.
Right.
But the older you get, your brain doesn't rebound in the same way. And so that one night of missed sleep is actually pretty significant. So if you don't get any sleep, and I don't think we all really talk about this enough, you can only live 11 days without sleep because of toxic overload.
How could you possibly stay awake for 11 days? I've thought of that, and I'm like, I do not think I could pull an all-nighter now, and imagining doing that for 11 days.
For 11 days.
I guess in torture, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Right, and you think about how that impacts people,
right.
That sleep deprivation. Yeah. It's fascinating because you can live without water for 3 to 4. And, okay, so think about food. You can live for 21 days without food. Think how you feel when you fast for a day and how tired and hungry and just discombobulated you feel.
I feel like that after 2 hours without food.
Right. But so 21 days. So we experience that outwardly, but sleep, sometimes we minimize the impact. So, I mean, that's 10 days less that you would need to die from sleep. So most of us are not going to go 11 days without sleep. So what happens with limited sleep? One study suggests that even one sleepless night appears to leave behind an excess of that troublesome protein fragment, the A-beta plaque. So really making sure that you're getting sleep each and every night is critical. So I love this concept of brain constipation. I just think it's a good image.
Yes.
It's a good image. So what does brain constipation lead to? These are some of the biggies: chronic fatigue, confusion, poor decision-making, headaches, irritability, variability in mood, emotional reactivity, weight gain. That's a bummer. Depression, heart disease, and long-term degenerative brain diseases. We've talked about Alzheimer's, but also Parkinson's. So when we talk about this, you know, some people do need a little bit less sleep. Some are at less risk, just like anything in life. But what they really believe is that poor sleepers appear to have a 68% higher risk than those that are rested. So get some sleep. So here's what Jeff Stibel says. I love this quote. He says, none of us are immune, no matter how busy or important you are. So the next time you start thinking about how to better yourself, improve productivity, or stay ahead of the herd, lose the bravado and just go to bed.
I like that.
And he has a great USA Today article on exactly this. His name's Jeff Stibel. It's S-T-I-B-E-L. And now I'm going to hand it over to Michelle.
Okay, thanks, Lisa. All right, I'm going to ask you to do a little exercise. So I want you to think of a time, whether it was today or something in your past, of a memory, of something that evoked a positive emotion. So it could be something nice you did for somebody else, or it could be something nice that somebody did for you, or just a beautiful sunset that you noticed, but something that actually made you feel a positive emotion. So once you've brought that memory into your mind, I want you to savor that memory by focusing on what it feels like. Imagine that memory absorbing into you. Notice the senses. Notice your senses. Notice what you feel like in your body when you have that feeling, and just let it sink in. And when spend about 10 seconds doing that. So basically, this exercise is the beginning of rewiring your brain. And what I'm going to talk about today are little things that you can incorporate. And even if it's 20 seconds of your time, even if you're doing it in the car or while you're brushing your teeth, there's things that we can do based on the concept of neuroplasticity that can help rewire your brain so that you boost your stress resiliency. And we know how connected stress is to sleep. And so if you are boosting your stress resiliency, you are going to end up sleeping better. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the brain and how stress impacts it. And then I'm going to give you additional tools so you can start to rewire your brains. So neuroplasticity, which is an amazing concept, and Lisa was talking a little bit earlier about, we have our brains are much more pliable when we're younger, and we used to think that they kind of stopped at a certain age and that they weren't as pliable as we got older, but we now know that the ability for our brain to change throughout our life is there. And what happens is that the gray matter can change and we can strengthen the synapses. And there's a saying that I really like that's neurons that fire together, wire together. So from every experience, thought, feeling, or physical sensation you have triggers thousands of neurons, which form a neural network. And so when you repeat an experience over and over, the brain learns to trigger the same neurons each time. So essentially, we have to practice things over and over to have that installed in our brain and to have a positive experience really sink in and to start rewiring. So that exercise that I just had you do, essentially we can do really great things throughout the day and we can notice a flower and we can do all of that. But if we don't have a feeling associated with it, then it's not going to do anything to our brain. And by making these experiences have feelings that go with them that are positive, we are really making some good changes to our brain. So I'm going to share an example. So Jack and I, Jack's my son, my 6-year-old. We took a family ukulele class, and we started. I know
it's very funny.
It is very funny. It was quite funny. So I never.
It was very fun.
Oh no, it was funny
really
too.
Fun.
It was very fun. I played the piano for like 2 years, but I've never played an instrument like this, and I'm not musically inclined. And so the first day of class, I was just like lost in my brain. You know, they're showing us these notes, and my hands it took me so long to just even get into the position. And meanwhile, my 6-year-old was like, "Mom, this is G. This is," like, he immediately would learn it and remember it. And we got home and we're practicing, and it took me forever to learn these new chords, and it was so frustrating that I wanted to be like, forget it, I can't do this, it's too hard, my brain is old, I can't do it. But then I started, you know, I was like, I'm going to force myself to practice. And I practiced, and I practiced, and I just played Blowin' in the Wind in a recital, which was Okay, it was awful, but we did. It was our last class. But, and I'm terrible, but I was able to see this concept of neuroplasticity in action, because now I could sit down and I could show you like what the G chord is and I can go right into it. So that's a perfect example of allowing like neurons to that firing and wiring together and creating. Now I have that memory that sticks, and I ended up having a positive experience with it. So in terms of like neural pathways, we all know the feeling of tubing or sledding on a hill that's like really icy, or tons of sledders have gone on it before us. It's really quick and it's really fast. And essentially like all the neural pathways in our brain that have been there for a while are kind of like that. We just immediately go to them because we've practiced them a lot, and it just happens. And so that's why we like our habits that are already ingrained are kind of like that. They're easy to just do. But when you imagine what it's like to put a tube in 12 inches of fresh powder and start sledding, it's tough work, and it takes a while, and you have to kind of be committed to doing the work to get it to turn into that awesome like sled ride that you really want. And that's exactly how our brains work. So it takes energy to create these like positive experiences that we want to ingrain in the hardwire of our brain. And we can do that, and it can take work at first, but eventually that it becomes habit, and it becomes just like that quick sledding.
I love that analogy.
I know.
It's really super clear, because it's true. When we're trying to do something new, especially with sleep, right? When we have that pattern of grabbing our phone when we wake up.
Right, exactly.
And then training our brain not to do that, you have to work, as silly as that sounds, you have to work hard not to grab for
Well,
that.
It's such a quick fix. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk about that a little bit later in terms of like why we grab for those things that actually make things in the long term worse for us, but in the short term seem to help or feel better. Right. And we do get the dopamine as we learn, like for anyone who saw Screenagers, I mean, like the texting and all of that, it gives us this quick dopamine fix. But ultimately, over time, we're not getting the really good stuff that we need by creating these like positive, you know, the feel-good things that come from connecting with another human being is not the same as the quick dopamine rush.
It's a great analogy.
So, yeah, I love that we know this about the brain, and this is all like really recent research, and it's amazing. But the reason that we have to work so hard to ingrain some habits and not others are because of what is known as the negativity bias, which is basically that bad things stick in our brain like Velcro, and good things do not. They basically just filter through like really quickly. And so we have to work really hard to make those good things stick. Whereas we will, so think about it, if your husband could do, or wife could do 20 amazing things for you, and then they get home late for dinner and like forget it. None of those other things really count. But that's the thing that you remember. Or your kid comes home and is talking about, they're not talking about the, you know, 20 great interactions they had with a friend. They're going to tell you about the one fight they got into, or when that person was mean to them. And that's how our brains, because of our ancestors, are designed to look, to basically be scanning for threats. And the reason that is because if we survived something in ancient days, we had to remember it. So if somebody ate a poisonous berry and died, everybody else had to remember those berries are poisonous, or those snakes bite and will kill us, and those other ones don't. So those things had to be really hardwired into our brains and created very strong neural pathways. And really, our hardwiring never got updated, and we still have the exact same brain. And the problem is that now, with the way that our society is, our brains respond the same way to everyday stressors that aren't threatening to our life as they did back then to life-threatening circumstances. And so we're always scanning for those things, we're picking up on them, and then we're not installing the good as much, even if we're having a lot of good experiences. So the tools we're going to talk about are really ways to install the good so that it helps to negate some of the bad.
So I was reading this research recently that really stuck for me, that if you look at your baseline, which is how you feel just every day, and you have a positive experience, it doesn't actually take, this is to what you're saying, it doesn't actually take a negative experience to bring you back down to baseline. We just automatically come back down pretty right. quickly. Whereas if we have a negative experience and we go below that baseline, mm-hmm. to be brought back up to baseline, depending on the person, it can take 2 or 3 positive experiences to bring us back up to that baseline.
Right.
Which is fascinating.
It is.
Because you do have to really start to pay attention to that, because just recognizing yes. it makes an enormous difference in our brain, right?
Right. And they say with relationships that it takes, for one bad thing that occurs, it takes 5 good things to kind of balance that out. So that goes to what you're saying, that it mm-hmm. really, we really have to work at that other stuff to have, because of the way that our brains are wired for survival.
Right. Super interesting.
Another interesting discovery in our brains are mirror neurons. And so mirror neurons essentially are neurons that they've discovered that we have in our brain that light up when we see somebody else having an emotional experience. So essentially these are like the root of empathy. So when we, this is why we smile when we see a baby smiling and we have this reciprocal experience, because with their mirror neurons are lighting up and they're happy, and then we feel happy when we look at them. And so same thing for sports fans. You wonder, like, what, how are people so emotional about sports? Like, you're watching football and you get so into it. And those people that are playing, like, they've got adrenaline rushing. They are, so we are looking at them, and especially if you've played the sport, you probably have more intensity. Our mirror neurons are firing when we are watching, like, how stressed out they are, how excited they are. So we feel what other people around us are feeling. And why this is so relevant to what we're talking about with sleep and stress is that our children's brains are picking up on exactly what we're feeling. So even if we are doing all the right things and we are sending our kids to an amazing school and we have them playing instruments, we have them playing the ukulele. we have them, you know, going to lessons, and we're doing all these awesome things and even saying all the right things to them. It actually doesn't matter, because if we are not regulated ourselves, and we are not, and we don't have resiliency with stress, our kids are going to pick up on their brain will feel what we're feeling. And so that interferes with their development. And so it's really important. I think it's like the best gift that you can give to your kids to take care of yourself in this way, because this is something, the way that their brain gets wired at this point is going to stick with them for life. And it takes a lot of work to change it. So, just a little bit more about the classic stress response as we move forward. So I think everybody knows what fight or flight is. Basically, when we see something really, like, you know, if we ran into a bear in the woods, we would, our amygdala would get activated, which is basically like our alarm system in our brain. And at that point, cortisol, adrenaline, and a bunch of other hormones actually get flooded into our system. We become emotionally charged, and our heart rate goes up, our blood pressure goes up, we are ready to fight. And this is really, you know, again, survival mechanism. But what also happens is that when this gets activated, it ropes off access to our prefrontal cortex. And our prefrontal cortex is our smart brain, and this is the part of our brain that is responsible for decision making.
I'm only laughing because it's the last to develop. So when you think about adolescence, right? This is the part that is often missing.
Right. And I think, I look at my son sometimes, and I mean, he's 6, but it's like, I have to remember sometimes that he does not, like, impulse control and all of that, it's not there yet.
It's just not there yet.
Yeah, it's not. But that's why we act like toddlers sometimes, because when we're chronically stressed out, we don't have access to our prefrontal cortex.
Right.
And so the other thing, in addition to, like, I think we all know that the prefrontal cortex is responsible for all these analytical things, but it's also where we have emotions and vulnerability. And so when we're in fight or flight mode and our amygdala is activated, we can't really connect with other human beings. So if we have everyone in a family who's in fight or flight mode, we're not having like true connection. We're not really present. And it's really, you know, can have really tough effects. So let's see. So one of the things with looking at like how our brain was wired for ancestors and how it's wired now is having the same structure, But now the way that things are is we are essentially, most of us are in kind of chronic stress because the stuff that activates our amygdala, as I was saying, our brain can't tell the difference between a bear and reading a text, essentially. So every time we get a ding for a text, our amygdala gets activated. So it sees it as a stressor. So we are constantly being triggered. Our limbic system, our amygdala, is constantly being triggered when we think about how crazy most of our lives are right now, just with technology. I mean, we talk a lot about technology, but just the constant distractions. Like, the workday is not what it used to be. It used to be, if most of us, I don't know, depending on how old people are, for me in my 40s, like, when my parents got home at the end of the day, that was it for work. It was like, no, you know, you were at home. And now it's like our work days never end. We are constantly, there's so much stimulation and there's so much running around that if we think about the fact that our amygdala is getting, we're having spikes constantly, that it makes it, you were talking about baseline before. If we think about our baseline being like when our prefrontal cortex is engaged, that should be kind of where our baseline is. We may have like little ups and downs, but that's where we need to be able to think clearly, to be able to connect with people, and to be able to sleep well. Mm-hmm. Because if we aren't at our baseline, we're activated in a way that doesn't allow us to regulate, to be able to fall asleep. And so what essentially happens, like, for a lot of people is their baseline shifts. So their baseline goes up to a place where it's, you know, where we're functioning from every day is a lot higher, and we lose access over time to our prefrontal cortex, and that can become kind of the new normal for us. And so we really have to actively, this is where the neuroplasticity comes in, we really have to actively negate the effects of this amygdala stimulation and being in fight or flight, because otherwise all of these hormones, all this stuff, this like havoc that's occurring neurologically is, you know, causes disease and causes all these problems, in addition to not feeling good. But you can see how over time, if you end up with this new baseline, you end up, like you were talking about earlier, Lisa, it feels good to, like, okay, I'm just going to get on Pinterest. Like, that feels like a good solution to it at night when you have this crazy day and you get home, or I'm going to have a glass of wine, because that works, and it does work. It works in the short term. You feel better. But what it's actually doing over time, if you're chronically using coping skills that disconnect you from your, you know, emotional state, is you're getting really disconnected from your prefrontal cortex and you're losing access to it. And then that's a really dangerous place to be. Yeah, some of the other, you know, kind of defenses that people use that can go, because sometimes I'll have clients that come in and they're like, no, I'm doing all the right things. I work out, I meditate, I do this. But when we actually really talk about it, sometimes those coping skills that sound like those positive things that we're supposed to be doing, those can also be distracting. It kind of depends what you're doing. Because if we're not having this time to like downregulate and kind of space just to be, then even exercising can be something that is more activating rather than stress reducing. So I think we really have to look at like how we're using our coping skills. And so I'm going to talk about coping skills that we know that really help to rewire our brain. And I love this quote from Jon Kabat-Zinn, which is, you can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. So we obviously, there's all kinds, especially this time of year, it's like insanity. It was funny, I was saying to my husband last night, like, oh my gosh, I feel like after Halloween, it's just insane until January. And he's like, really? I think it's like a great time of year. I was like, maybe it's like moms. I don't know. I don't mean to be like gender specific, but I just feel like I just feel like everything gets out of whack because, and it is exciting and it's fun, but there's so much more going on. That I feel like this is a really good time of year to use these skills every day.
Agreed.
Yeah. Okay. So, and another quote by Vincent van Gogh, great things are done by a series of small things being brought together. So the things I want to talk about today are things that I know as busy parents, none of the things that I'm going to ask you to do will add any more time to your day. All of these things are things that you can do either brushing your teeth while you're in car line, while you're driving to work, while you are waiting in traffic. So just think of, if you can start implementing these things, they're all researched and evidence-based ways to help create a better mind that is going to help you sleep better. So the first one is mindfulness, and as we all know, that's kind of a buzzword in the past 5 or so years. So the way that I would define it is basically be like a kid. Kids do not have to learn mindfulness. If you watch, like I watched my 1.5-year-old little nephew and him at a park, it's like he stops every moment just to notice a piece of grass and he pays attention to the texture of things. And so it's his senses are fully engaged. As adults, we get completely caught up in our heads and we stop doing that. So you can practice mindfulness, which is basically being in the present moment without judging. At any time, and it doesn't have to be like you do not have to go to a monastery for a month to do this. You can just stop and I like the practice of whenever you're at a red light, pay attention to the color red and just notice it and engage your senses. And that's it. That's a practice of focusing your attention. And basically what you're doing is you are working the muscle that is going to help you that when you're in fight or flight that you can calm down. When you need it. So if you're practicing these mindfulness skills when you're not stressed out, you're going to have the most leverage to use them when you are, and it's going to reduce your vulnerability from getting off track.
Well, in mindfulness, right, we were going to talk about this a little bit later, but I think it's good to talk about it now, that it gets attached to meditation, which they obviously are connected, but then we feel a little bit nervous about doing that. You know, can we do it right? Do we know how to do it? And to your point, it's actually really not that complicated.
Right.
It can be really simplistic. It can be taking 3 deep breaths and counting and really paying attention to how that breath fills into your body and really settling in, right?
Yeah.
And utilizing that. And it goes back to your concept of the hill, right? Mm-hmm. The sled hill.
Yes.
That the more you practice, then it becomes...
Exactly.
A slippery road where it's really easy to take advantage of that when you're struggling to sleep.
Well, and it's also the way that the brain connects is if you are practicing this enough, you're automatically going to go there and do it. So it's
really important stuff.
It is. And especially thinking about being parents, there was a study out of UCLA that showed that for parents that practice mindfulness themselves, and I don't know exactly what it looked like, but it wasn't an extensive practice, after a year of daily practice, their kids showed less aggression, improved social skills, and improved grades. And there was no intervention on the child. And so the kids weren't even practicing mindfulness. The kids can do mindfulness, and that would be great. But just for parents just doing this, you're going to impact your whole family in a great way. So it's kind of just slowing down. You know, we don't get downtime in our life. So it's really kind of just slowing down and paying attention to what's in your body rather than what's in your head. Because we really, with the way our society is, we have to listen to our thoughts so much and we stop listening to what's inside of our body. And we really need to be connected with that. So that brings me to my next tip, which is noticing your core emotions. So we have about 6 or 7 core emotions that universally we know across cultures we all share, and we're born with these emotions and we have them to help navigate the world and help us survive. So they all have functions. Anger, sadness, fear, disgust, joy, and excitement are the main ones. And if you remember the movie Inside Out, I think that's a great example that she really couldn't be okay until she let sadness in. And so I think it's really important to recognize and kind of, I tell people, you know, when you're brushing your teeth at night, just go through this list of emotions and think what experiences did I have where I felt these emotions today? Because we usually don't have the time to stop and connect and notice a feeling, but they're really important in order for us to feel regulated, because when we get in the habit of shutting off our experience of feelings, we end up developing a lot of symptoms, but we can't fall asleep. It makes sleep really hard if we have stuff that's kind of on our mind that gets shoved away, and kind of that's a general idea of like the subconscious too, like the stuff. So if we're, you know, our brains at night when we fall asleep and wake up in the middle of the night, like when there's a lot of stuff going on that had to be pushed away, like that's going to happen, or it makes it really hard when you lay down at night because all this stuff comes flooding in.
Well, I think we're trained, right, to think that we're supposed to live. I mean, if you look at the continuum, that joy and suffering really live on that same continuum. And societally, we're taught we're supposed to live over on the side of joy.
Right.
But in reality, we live in the center of that continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And to your point about pushing sadness away or suffering or struggle, it's unrealistic. And we place these really unrealistic expectations on ourselves to live in this space of joy, and it doesn't work.
Right.
And so then when we're sleeping and we're vulnerable, all of that starts to come up. And so recognizing that it's a really beautiful part of life, it's a really normal part of life, is an enormous benefit for sleep later. And when you talk about that mirror neuron, your children understanding that life doesn't always live on that joy side of the spectrum is really impactful too.
And I think it's interesting to notice, if you pay attention to like ways that you might do this, I think we all tend to like minimize the emotions that we've gotten the message like aren't okay for some reason. Or, and I notice that I have clients all the time that will say things like, I shouldn't be around feelings, or I don't want to be angry at my sister because she means well. And I always stop them and I say, you know, she can mean well and you can also be angry. Like, you can feel love for her but also be angry at her. And you're minimizing that by saying like the should statement with feelings. And so really getting to notice that all these things can coexist, like you're saying, mm-hmm. and they need to, because our society, I think, does give us the message that, like, certain feelings aren't okay. And with gender, this comes up a lot with gender, which, you know, where, like, boys have more permission to express anger and girls have less, maybe. And boys, it's harder for them to express, like, more vulnerable emotions. Mm-hmm. So really recognizing that we all have to notice this, I think, really can help with sleep. The other thing with feelings, because I think this is so important, is that remembering they're not right or wrong. And feelings should be like waves. They should rise up and then come down. And typically when they rise up, people oftentimes freak out and think, I can't handle this. This is overwhelming. And that's when we go to those, like the glass of wine or the Facebook or whatever, because we're really uncomfortable with our emotional state. But what is really helpful in the new neural pathway that, you know, development that we're talking about is sitting back and observing the discomfort and letting it naturally transform. And so mindfulness, if we're slowing down and we're really paying attention to these feelings, over time, it is really freeing to see, like, I can handle feeling overwhelmed and I can handle all my feelings. Because a lot of the symptoms that I see with, like, clients that I see are because they're avoiding just normal feelings.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think what's really important to remember with this, too, is, like, feelings are rooted in our body. So focusing on physical sensations that sometimes we get disconnected from is so important, because all of these feelings are physiologically rooted, and the way that we know we feel them is by a physical sensation. So that can really be a good way to help connect with us. Another thing to help is focusing on not believing everything you think. I saw a bumper sticker the other day that said, don't believe everything you think. And I was like, that's a great way of looking at kind of examining that we tend to interpret our thoughts as facts. And if we stop and realize that, you know, our thoughts are not facts, what we really need to listen to is what's going on internally versus our thoughts, because they're influenced by so many different things, and we really can end up getting misled. And really, usually when we're stuck in our head and thoughts, we are more in fight or flight, actually, and we're not connected with our prefrontal cortex. So just observing this can be helpful. The other thing that we talked a little bit about is like breathing, and I went to a trauma training recently where this guy was talking about, he tells people to relax your body 200 times a day. And he's like, I know that's unrealistic because most people do it like five, maybe one, but to have that being a goal, and he, you know, what happens throughout the day is, as our amygdala has these responses to stress, we continue to tense up and tense up. And every time we have a spike or an experience that causes us stress, our body gets really tense. And so if we get in the habit of telling ourselves, relax, breathe and relax your body randomly throughout the day, we are helping to combat the buildup of that stress. And if we are, it's also interesting to think about, you can be in a stressful situation and not be stressed. Because I think sometimes we feel like you're in traffic and you're like really tense and it's like, oh, I can be in traffic and take a deep breath and relax my body. Just because I'm in a stressful situation, I don't have to be stressed. And intervening at a physical body level can really help, because when we're in fight or flight, our amygdala does not react to logic. So I think this is just a really helpful, easy technique. Another thing is just doing an act of kindness. So when we talked about that experience earlier, and recalling something that brought up a positive emotion, if we think about doing something nice for somebody else, think about something nice that somebody did for us, it really creates a positive emotion that we can install into our brain, and it can help take us back to our baseline. One other real simple thing, I just call it grounding, and it's basically shifting your thoughts from the past or the future to just being in the present moment in a mindful way, and then sensing your feet on the ground. So you literally and immediately just focus the soles of your feet and feel the ground beneath you, and just kind of notice what the floor feels like. And the purpose of this is just to get you out of your head and your thoughts and allow you to kind of connect to the earth. And this kind of helps you to connect to yourself. And usually if you spend, like, you're in a meeting, you're at work doing it, this is something, you don't have to spend a half hour with this practice, but it can really just be, implementing this can just be a quick way to help reduce vulnerability. Okay, I think that is all for tips, and I'm going to hand it back over to Lisa.
That was all very good stuff. I was just going to say about grounding, what's really interesting when you talk about stress response and reconnecting to the earth. They did this interesting study. I don't know if you guys have ever read anything about earthing. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Where you go barefoot and you stand actually in the grass, and the experience of the grass on your feet, they actually found that it reduced stress and anxiety pretty significantly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And they said, you know, if you're living, obviously in Colorado, we don't have a ton of grass right now. It's cold outside. But even just standing barefoot on the ground, right, where you can actually access the earth, has an actual physiological effect.
Oh, wow.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
So grounding is really critically important. So just briefly, we've talked, Michelle and I have talked a lot about this, that most people understand practicing good sleep hygiene, but I think it bears repeating. I'll go through them pretty quickly because I think it's stuff that just needs a basic reminder. One is just to maintain a regular sleep routine, going to bed at the same time every night, trying to wake up at a similar time. This is obviously really hard. These are optimal tips for if you really want to do your very best with sleeping. Avoiding caffeine, alcohol, nicotine, and other chemicals that interfere with sleep too close to bedtime. Interestingly, what they show is those 7 hours of sleep. If you have one glass of wine close to bedtime within that 4 to 6 hours, you need to actually add back in an hour of sleep for every glass of wine that you've had. So it's not that you cannot do that, but maybe try to have your glass of wine or your cocktail at 5 if you're going to go to bed at 10, right? If it gets closer, just make sure that maybe you have a little bit of time to sleep in, or you might have time to nap the next day. Alcohol, actually, right, we need to process it. That's why it slows us down a little bit in sleep. Exercise is the third one, which promotes good quality sleep. exercise, like Michelle was talking about, sometimes can stimulate our body. So we want to be careful not to do it too close to sleep, but it's actually very good to get every day. The fourth one is to steer clear of foods that can be disruptive prior to sleep. Some foods, like heavy foods, spicy foods, they're hard to digest, and so our body is busy digesting. But the other piece is heartburn. Not everybody gets heartburn, but heartburn can really disrupt our sleep. And so sitting up, if you eat some of these foods close to bedtime, can actually help that heartburn not come up and cause problems for you during sleep. This is a huge one. Number five is ensuring adequate exposure to natural light. We are entering into the winter. Seasonal affective disorder is a real thing. We need sun. We're lucky to be in Colorado, but if you're in an office building, taking a sun break during the day, even if it's 10 minutes, going outside and getting a little bit of sunshine is important. I know when I used to work in the hospital, it is dark in there and you do not get any natural sun. So making sure you're getting out.
The whole vitamin D thing, it's that people think in Colorado that mm-hmm. we're fine because there is so much sun, but apparently there's like really low levels of vitamin D.
Well, yeah. And interestingly, we put a lot of sunscreen on, and sunscreen's important to protect from skin cancer, but we also need to allow the sunshine to seep into our body. So we have to balance that. I mean, I don't want to encourage anybody not to put on sunscreen, but just having a balance. The next one is napping early or not at all. Naps are complicated. Some people love them, and it doesn't impact their sleep later. Some people cannot do them. I personally cannot nap, but that is a personal thing. Balancing fluid intakes. Obviously, the older you get, the more you have to use the bathroom in the middle of the night, so making sure that you don't drink too much water close to bedtime. This is a really important one, keeping your bedroom environment optimal. They actually have now come out with they're sheets that help you to manage the temperature in your bedroom.
Oh, wow.
So that I had never heard of this either, but if you have a spouse who loves it really warm in the bedroom, you actually should be sleeping in a room that's 60 to 75 degrees. I could never 60? Sleep in a room that's 75 degrees. Oh, that'd be too hot for me. But what they've shown is that there's these, I think they were created at the Mayo Clinic. I might be making that up. But and they manage your temperature. So they regulate it and help to bring down your temperature if you need it. So that's a really important one. Obviously, keeping it dark. And, you know, they like to say that limit your bedroom activities to sleep and sex only. That is really hard. But if you really struggle with sleep, if you can keep the bedroom to those two things, it actually, same thing you were saying with the neural pathways, you walk in, you sit down in your bed, you know what's coming, right? It's one of those two things. So, and yeah. So we don't need to keep talking about that. The next one is limit blue light exposure before bed. The light from our screens trick our brain into thinking that it's daytime again. Your brain perceives that blue light to be sunlight. The devices can also stress or excite you, like you were talking about with Facebook and emails. And at the very least, just trying to stop using the blue lights for an hour before you go to sleep. The next one is to power down. Sleep is obviously not an on and off switch. We expect our body to go from going 100 miles an hour to dropping down into zero immediately. And when it doesn't, we start to get frustrated. And that's the next one, is staying calm when you can't sleep. We start to get excited that, oh my gosh, maybe I'm not going to get to sleep. Relax. It takes some time to go to sleep. Read a book, take a bath. Meditate. We're going to talk about a couple more sleep hacks here. So jump in with these. These are sleep hacks when you can't sleep. So sleep hygiene is what you should be doing to get your best sleep. Sleep hacks is, holy cow, I seriously can't sleep.
So if we look at this, like the stuff that I was talking about, stress and reducing your vulnerability, overall in terms of lifestyle, like kind of implementing those things is great, and the sleep hygiene. And then when you can't, these are the things that when you're up at night and it's like you really need sleep, this is what you can do.
Right. And sleep hacks are critically important because we all need them, even if you're the best sleeper. I'm a great sleeper, but there are times I wake up at night and these are the things that I have to call on too. So mindfulness practice, obviously Michelle talked a lot about that, but stress and anxiety playing a big role in insomnia. So if you practice mindfulness on a regular basis, it becomes easier in the evening. I thought this was really fascinating. A 2011 study found that mindfulness-based stress reduction is seen to be as effective as a prescription drug.
Wow.
Which is really fascinating. So if you actually can practice this, it will help you sleep.
So that's the one thing that I notice is that people that have, if you're not practicing it regularly and you attempt to use it as a sleep hack, oftentimes people like feel anxious because you were so not used to slowing down.
Totally.
So then that can, so when you're practicing it regularly, I think this is an amazing
It's an amazing
to
tool, but yeah. You do have to practice it because yeah. otherwise our body doesn't know how to access it in the middle of the night. And one of the questions that I ask is how you think about mindfulness practice, how that gets in your way. Because we think about mindfulness practice and think that it's just this buzzword and, you know, oh, that's hokey. Mm-hmm. And that stops us from actually practicing it. And it's one of the most effective tools. Well, I think it is the most effective tool.
I think the best part of it for me, I think, is developing the ability to observe your thoughts. And again, not interpret them as facts. So if you wake up in the middle of the night and you're like, oh my God, I have to be at work at this time. Now I'm only going to get 4 hours of sleep. I'm never going to be able to function. That's a thought that then your body reacts to that as if that's a stressor. Whereas if you notice, okay, that's just a thought, and you reconnect with your body, you actually, that's a practice of mindfulness. It's like you're allowing your body not to get into that fight or flight place and react to the thought.
Right. And that mindfulness place of, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do it. And we listed a bunch of apps, which we don't have to read off. But, you know, part of it is, there are lots of different ways to be mindful, right? I mean, we need to do body scan. Like, if your mind starts going to those thoughts and we start to race,
yeah,
then how do you get off that mm-hmm. cycle?
Yeah.
And you have to give your mind something else to think about. So whether it's your breath or whether it's a body scan, there's lots of apps for this.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So, yeah, these are the apps that help. Sometimes, like, not having your own thoughts in your head and kind of replacing them with like the person who's speaking mm-hmm. helps you just to have that space from yourself if you tend to be someone who gets anxious about insomnia or falling back asleep.
Well, and this goes back to when we were talking about the difference between sleep hygiene and sleep hacks. Sleep hygiene, obviously, it's optimal to leave your phone out of the room. And sometimes we can't sleep. And
right.
so can some of these apps be helpful to play
right.
in the background?
Right.
This is going against the concept of sleep hygiene, but sometimes
yeah.
it's helpful. And so understanding that and having...
Being flexible
enough
yeah.
to do that.
Doing what works and what's effective.
So there's yeah. some great ones in here, and if anybody's interested, we can get them the list of that.
Yeah.
There's also a bunch of podcasts. You can speak to this a little bit. I know you did a little bit more research on some podcasts, and I know you use this with your daughter, correct?
Yeah, well, we use something that I just find on YouTube, and it's like, I think we just Google like kids sleep meditation, and it's like a parachute or it's like a visualization for kids, and she finds it really helpful. But, and there's a ton of stuff on YouTube if you know, and to do things together with your kids, I think can be really helpful mm-hmm. because it's really good for them too. There are also podcasts that there's this guy named Drew Ackerman, and he has two podcasts. One's called Sleep With Me and the other one's called Game of Drones. And he's somebody who suffered from insomnia for a long time. And he started this podcast because he found that listening to like really boring stories helped him to fall asleep, but he kind of needed to feel like somebody else was with him, and because he felt really anxious, like, and he felt really alone, like falling asleep, and it was scary, like in the middle of the night. And so he created this podcast where he talks in a really monotonous voice and kind of like Game of Drones, I guess. I haven't listened to this, but he goes through episodes, and he's like, I don't talk about the exciting things. Like, I will talk about, like, the details of what a piece of grass looked like on the ground, or so he'll just talk like really, like around really boring things. And apparently, he has millions of followers all over the world, and it's really helpful as a distraction and just to get out of your head.
It's so interesting, and I was. There were a couple other ones of podcasts. I thought his were really interesting, but there's one called Daily Meditation Podcast, and they're really short, and she does something different each day to help people relax and go to sleep, and she has tons of followers too in that Daily Meditation Podcast. And then there's a few other, there's a hypnotherapist who does meditation mini podcasts that are really short as well. And a lot of people find those really helpful. I think it's worth a shot if you can't sleep. So those are some of the podcasts. This is, so the next one is called 478 Breath Pattern. This is one of my most favorite. It's what I use. It's based on an ancient Indian practice that means regulation of breath. So basically what you do is you breathe in four, and then you hold for seven, and then you breathe out for a count of eight. So you breathe in four, so it's quick and big. So you breathe. So imagine, do it right now.
Breathe in through your nose.
Right.
So through your nose.
Breathe in through your nose. Four.
Okay.
Hold for seven, and then breathe out very slowly for a count of eight. Because you'll find that you're gasping almost towards the end. So it takes a little bit of practice. It's a good thing to start practicing maybe when you're in traffic. And the reason for it, the reason for the four in, is because when we breathe in, we're actually stimulating. I mean, think about what you're doing when you're breathing in. You're stimulating every organ in your body. You're stimulating everything. You're adding oxygen. And when you're breathing out, you're actually relaxing your body, which is why the breath out is double the breath in. So if you can't remember anything else, because I find that this happens to me at night, a simple breathing pattern of even 4 to 6 or 4 to 8, whatever you can do that's comfortable for you at night will help. I have a lot of clients who tell me, I tried that, that didn't help. It takes practice. And you really have to focus on the count of your breath so that you can turn your mind off and focus on the breath. If you can do that, a lot of people with insomnia, this is one of the most helpful ones. There also is a app, it's called Stop, Breathe, Think, where they focus on this 4-7-8 breathing. So,
and again, like you're saying, really, I mean, I notice that a lot in my practice too, that people will say, I tried that and it didn't work. With a lot of different things. And we go back to like the neural pathway thing, and we have to practice these things. I know we're talking about sleep hacks, but it's kind of like the idea that you're not going to go run a marathon tomorrow if you haven't been running. And it's the same thing. Like, a lot of these things will not work if you're not doing them regularly. And you can do it for 2 minutes a day and you'll get the benefit of it.
Huge benefit. Exactly. So just a couple more. I know we're running short on time. No idea how long we've been talking.
I think it's like an hour and a half.
I know. We need to. So we might have to cut some things out for you people. So music and soothing noise is another sleep hack. This music is really powerful. Michelle and I have talked a lot about this. People actually have done studies on music, and they found that the more you do it, those effects multiply over time. And so then when you turn on that calming music, it actually immediately takes you to that place of calm. So that is very powerful. The next one is aromatherapy. Essential oils are huge. One of the things I'd like to say is, obviously they've done a lot of research on lavender, but they found that jasmine actually works even more effectively than lavender. I think that that's fascinating. We don't use jasmine regularly. The other piece that I think is really, really important to understand about aromatherapy is if you rub essential oils on your body, you can have a reaction because they're very potent. So one of the best ways I found in my house with my kiddos is that you take a little bit of essential oil and you put it on their feet. And when you rub it into their feet, your feet actually absorb oils more effectively than anywhere else on your body, with the exception of your hands. But your hands, then you could touch your eyes. And plus, it's a really calming ritual with your kiddos. There's a fabulous essential oil called Thieves Oil. They used to use it. It's a mixture of a lot of different oils. And they used to use it, the gypsies used it when they would be up at night and breaking into people's houses. They would get sick. And one of the ways that they avoided getting sick was they created this thing called Thieves Oil, which is a mixture of a lot of different oils.
I've heard of that.
It's super cool. And so, and it smells really fantastic. And so I put it on my kids' feet. It's funny because it tickles, and so there's always this ritual around it, right? But you put it on their feet, and in the wintertime, it's supposed to...
Do your kids still let you do that?
Yes, they
do.
That's
sweet.
Even my junior in high school. But, you know, you just put it on their feet, and then you rub their feet a little bit, and that also is ritualistic in its own right, right? It's very calming. But there's lots of ways to use essential oils. I think they are underused. But rubbing it on your feet is actually very calming for yourself. And then, this is a huge slide, but journaling and paradoxical intention, we don't need to totally go into this, but it's basically leaning into your stress and worry. It's doing the opposite of what you think you should be doing. So we try back to that point of joy and suffering. We want to live on that side of joy, and so we avoid the other piece. But sometimes the best thing we can do for ourselves is to lean into that stress and worry and give ourselves permission. Journal about it. Say, what's going to worry me tonight? Write it down, get it out. And then if you wake up in the middle of the night, you say to yourself, I already wrote that down. If you think of something new, get up, add it to your worry list, and go back to sleep. So this idea of paradoxical intention, it actually is fascinating. We could probably do an hour talk on that. So I won't go totally into it. Maybe you'll have to listen to the next Take Care podcast. Maybe that will be what it's about. And then finally, deficiencies. I think this is worth noting. Melatonin is a hormone that's naturally produced in our bodies. It helps determine sleep and wake cycles. Light obviously affects its production. With blue light, it's big in impacting melatonin. And we were talking about this earlier, and I'll share it with you. I have not used it, so I'm going to acknowledge that I have no idea if it works. But there are some light bulbs out there that filter out the blue light. One of them that I thought was super interesting is called C-Sleep light bulb, like C the letter. And I guess it's connected to an app. And it's on a timer, so you can put it in the like lamp by your bed. And you can set it on the timer, and it takes the blue light out and helps you to relax. It's $20 on Amazon. I think it's worth a shot. I'm going to give it a shot. Magnesium, I do want to just mention some things to be aware of with magnesium. But first, I'll let you know, obviously, it does help with insomnia. It does help with depression. It is a wonderful, wonderful thing to drink in tea at night. It's very ritualistic. It can be super yummy. You can also take it in a pill form. I like to drink it as a tea. Just something to be aware of, if you're not deficient, you know what I'm gonna say? If you're not deficient in magnesium, it can really clean out your system. So it helps to keep you regular, and it can be a real benefit. But too much of it, and you might wanna be near a bathroom in the morning. Vitamin D is another one. We talked about that, so I won't go into that, but obviously it's really impactful for sleep. The other one that's not on here is vitamin B. They do a lot of vitamin B injections. I found that to be incredibly helpful with regulating my sleep. But you have to see if you're deficient in it. And I don't want to give anybody advice on that. So finally, prioritizing good sleep is good self-love. And we want everybody to take good care. So we hope you go to sleep. Go rest. Go to rest.
I put them to sleep. They may be asleep now.
you might be asleep.
This podcast may be like Drew Ackerman. This is the point of this was actually. Yes.
We might cut it into multiple stages. You're so glad you got to be part of our first podcast. Okay, we are going to sign off. Thank you for listening.